Okay, thank you, Sandy. Thank you, Julia, for that intro. I'm going to try and share my screen now.
Right, coming through.
It's coming through. Excellent. Here we go from the beginning. Okay, so I'm going to take a slightly more kind of well, both global and sort of schematic view of what's going on. A little bit more politics, perhaps, than Julia's presentation. And that's partly driven by reflecting on what happened up at COP26 and what it means for what we need to do going forward. So, yeah, COP26. Obviously, one of the most important things that's happened since the Paris Agreement. I'm not going to go through a sort of textual analysis of what came out of it. The question that does have to be answered is, will it deliver global net zero? And of course, the answer is no, that it was never going to do that. And in fact, COPs are never going to do that. Conferences at the moment are where countries come together to discuss the issue. They don't cut emissions per se, because that is still very much in the ballpark of individual nation states as to what they do, because the commitments that are made either at a COP or in the run-up to a COP are voluntary. There's no centralized framework saying this is what you must do. I mean, that was tried before. It was the framework for the climate talks running up to Copenhagen, where it finally ran into the sand. And so the different framework, which actually is starting to move somewhere, is where countries come with essentially what are your commitments? What are you that they offer up what they're prepared to do on climate change. And we have to hope everybody will join in enough to make it work. But one of the things that was obvious at this COP, when you're in the room, is just how much there are power politics at play. There was an intervention quite late on, as many of you may know, between India and China, to water down some of the phraseology about coal phase out. But in other parts of it, there were interventions by Saudi. There were things going on with the US as well. And of course, this matters because these are the big emitters, and the UK can do some important things. I'll come on to that later. But globally, we're not going to get to zero emissions without these people playing ball. So that aspect about it being voluntary and then bringing what they can to the table when they are either heavily dependent on the use or the extraction of fossil fuels becomes a major sticking point. Here's what I naughtily snapped as I went forward to see what was going on. In the center there is John Kerry, the negotiator for the US. Frans Timmermans is slightly hidden on the right. There's Gabon, who was representing G77, and this held up the entire event for something like an hour and a half while this haggling was going on in the room about what the final text would say. So there is some pretty brutal power politics going on, and you can see why. If for somebody like Saudi or for somebody like US with their heavy dependence, this is a zero emissions target is quite threatening. And so part of the deal in trying to get globally to net zero, and where the UK can play a role, is about making sure there is integrity in the process. And we have some accounting loopholes, I would say, with what was adopted at COP26 that will need a hell of a lot of attention if they're not going to be ways of looking good without actually being good, in particular the carbon markets as they opened up for offsets. Anyway, let me move on, because the other thing that was abundantly clear, and it's always been clear, but it really hits you in the face when you're in the room with developing countries who are being horribly hit by what we've already got. And Julia mentioned the what we've seen in terms of climate extremes that are driving, have driven problems all around the world. We've still got a kind of ongoing crisis in British Columbia and Canada at the moment with the flooding there, unquestionably now pretty much linked to climate change. But the developing countries are already experiencing that, which is why solidarity with developing nations is absolutely critical to delivering net zero globally. And the UK can actually have a role here, and a very important role internationally, because, as I say, if we don't get the solidarity right, and we don't get developing countries coming to join in, I don't want to say it doesn't matter what we actually do in the UK, because that's not true, but we are around 1% of emissions, and we need everybody to join in, and including those nations which are developing quite rapidly and potentially going to need more energy. So we need to, in the UK, reverse the international aid cut, because climate finance, which was a big talking point at the COP, is meant to be additional to international aid, not a replacement for it. And we've got this question about loss and damage. Just to fill that out a little bit, loss and damage is where those countries are already experiencing impacts of climate change. So this is from the Marshall Islands. It was about 2 years ago, but they were experiencing flooding, which they've never experienced before, through rising sea levels. And for the people in the Marshall Islands who have done nothing to cause this problem, but are now being hit by it, when the problem arose from what developing countries did over decades and centuries, you can see the sense of injustice there would be extremely powerful. And it's not just there, it's in obviously the other Pacific islands like Tuvalu, Vanuatu, but it's true in Bangladesh. It's true in Pakistan, experiencing heat waves unlike they've ever seen before. And the people there thinking, well, hang on, we've got this problem now, this massive problem, which is our climate is changing and making our lives unlivable. And we didn't cause it. There's nothing to do with us. So that's why the solidarity piece with developing countries experiencing these changes is not only a matter of morality and justice, it's also a matter of pragmatically essential to deliver the mitigation on emissions that we're going to need. And the UK can deliver leadership on mitigation as well as that solidarity package. And that's what I'm going to talk about now, as Julia covered it, as I thought, extremely well, as I expected rather. But what can we do as to provide international leadership on mitigation, so it goes beyond our 1% of global emissions? Well, one thing we can do, and we are doing actually, is be an exemplar on process. How do we go about what we do? We have a Climate Change Act. We have statutory advisors like the Climate Change Committee. We have reporting. So there's some good stuff in place. There are further questions that I would have about what are known as consumption emissions, in other words, not just happening within the UK's borders, but the global footprint of the UK. And that's quite considerable and goes some way beyond what is actually appears in our accounts. We'll also need to be an exemplar on fairness. I'll say a little bit more about that later. We can provide leadership through both delivery of new technology and coalitions of the willing. That was a feature of COP, that the UK was quite correctly trying to assemble coalitions of the willing on things like electric vehicles, on coal finance, and indeed on deforestation. And opinions will vary about how effective those coalitions look and how wide they are and how deep they are. But at least I think it was the right strategy to try and provide those coalitions of the willing who will go beyond what is in the formal COP text. We don't all have to go at the speed of Saudi Arabia. We can assemble groupings where where they go faster, and the UK can play an important role on that. It can play an important role on development of technology. We've done extremely well on offshore wind, as most people will be aware, and that technology is now something that is being rolled out in all sorts of places. And I get emails about what's going on in Vietnam, in China, in Taiwan, and the east coast of the US, and more. So that's a technology that we've helped develop and, made available to the world. And the other thing, the way we need to do international leadership, is on the delivery of our targets. Our targets are actually quite strong. They could be stronger, but they are, compared to international comparators, they're quite strong. So the thing that we've committed to internationally under the what's known as the UK NDC, the nationally determined contribution, 68% by 2030. That compares to a cut so far around 42%. So we're almost going to have to cut again by half from our pre-pandemic emissions by somewhere in the sort of early 2030s. We've got some stretching targets. Again, I emphasize if one were to take on the full nature of the climate crisis, you would say they'd actually need to be stronger. But they are challenging enough as they are. And this has to happen quickly. That's another thing that I would like to emphasize here. They have to happen quickly, because if you take the midpoint of our sixth carbon budget, that's about 13 years away or a bit more. It's not long. And I thought there was something, another piece there, but what that means is that most of the emissions cuts that we're going to deliver to get most of the way to zero emissions are going to have to be delivered largely by technologies that we already know exist and that we already have started to deploy. Innovation's great. And I certainly wouldn't want to discourage innovation in all sorts of areas, like, you know, industrial processes and some of the waste management. We'll need some innovation in various places as to how we go about it. But if you look at the what our 2019 emissions look like, you can see that the big stuff is transport, power, residential and business. And so we are going to have to take major chunks out of all of those in the next 8 years and further chunks in the next 13 years. So there isn't going to be some magic technology that comes along and helps us out with all that. It's mostly going to be stuff that we already know how to do. Which is why I say most emissions cuts will come from existing technology, which is ready for scaling up. And I can't emphasize enough how much the next decade is going to be critical on whether we keep climate to some kind of reasonable level of temperature rise. It's going to be determined over the next decade much more than it is by kind of 2050 targets or 2060 or 2070 targets. It's got to be delivered. A lot of it's got to be delivered in the next decade or so. So what does that mean for what we do to deliver net zero in the UK, focusing on that immediate need? Well, the strategy, as actually outlined by the Climate Change Committee in 2008, but since taken up by others like Energy Transition Commission, international grouping, is to electrify everything. Electrify wherever you can, because electricity can be made zero carbon. It's difficult to make an internal combustion engine car zero carbon. Not impossible, but difficult and probably quite inefficient. As Julia said, electric cars are four times more efficient than petrol and diesel cars. So zero carbon energy is going to be precious, and we need to use it well. So all of these things need to be rolled out at speed and scale. And people back at Greenpeace get quite bored of me saying this. Speed, scale, speed, scale, speed, scale. Those are the things that we need. So what are my big five in energy? I should say I'm not looking at talking about land use here, because there's all sorts of interesting and challenging stuff around diets and land use and rewilding and nature restoration and so on, which I'm not going to touch. But these are the ones for energy, which I thought you'd probably be most interested in. I call them the big five. So first of all, we need a big rollout of renewables, especially offshore wind. Offshore wind is going to be the backbone of the power system in the 2030s and 2040s. And there may be some other, you know, there's an important role for solar rollout, off onshore wind as well. You may think nuclear is a good idea. I don't, but nuclear is going to be a bit part if it plays much of a part at all. The backbone of all this stuff is going to be offshore wind. We have a target of 40 gigawatts by 2030. We need to keep rolling on at the sort of pace that we need to deliver that, and keep rolling on right through the 2030s and into the 2040s. It's the 2030 for the 40 gigawatt target offshore wind is not an end point. It's the platform for going further. We need to smarten and extend the grid and add storage. So there's going to be a lot of variable renewables on the grid. We need to have a grid that is capable of managing that well. Storage is a part of that. Demand side response is a part of that, so that we use electricity when it's available, where it's possible to shift demand, even by a few hours, that will help a lot. Interconnection is what I mean by extend the grid. If we interconnect with our European neighbours, then it becomes much easier to manage that high volume of variable renewables. And of course, we will need quite a lot of storage. There will still be, even if we extend the grid over large regions, there will still be periods of very low wind, and there will be periods of very high wind, and we will need to include storage in that. I was pleased to see this morning that there is funding for a green hydrogen project at Whiteley Wind Farm in about half an hour south of Glasgow. That's very welcome. I think we'll need to do quite a lot more of that. Obviously, batteries play a role, but they're not going to deal with those long duration all those periods where there isn't much wind in across the UK. Also, part of this is that our wind resources need to be spread. We're at the moment with very heavy concentration in Scotland and the North Sea. I think it's very helpful to have floating wind going into the Celtic Sea, which appears to be the next plan as we come up to the next renewables auction. Because that spreads, it makes the load management on the grid that much easier. So that's my number two. Electrified vehicle transport, we're doing that reasonably well. Again, an announcement this morning about new homes having electric chargers. That won't bail us out, but it will be very helpful, because then more and more homes will automatically have a vehicle charging point. The big challenge, of course, is going to be retrofit. Fortunately, the global car industry is now sort of steadily turning the supertanker towards electrification. So it feels like that's all going in the right direction. And there was also a welcome announcement about HGVs during COP, where the UK has said all new HGVs, including the 44-ton articulated types, are going to have to be zero emission at tailpipe by 2040. So we're making progress there. That's good. Where we're not so much making progress is efficiency in all buildings. That's residential and commercial. And efficiency also includes product standards, by the way, whether it's your phone or photocopiers or laptops. Zero carbon energy is going to be precious stuff, and we don't want to go around wasting it. We need a bit more coming from the efficiency we were a bit disappointed, frankly, at the absence of any kind of building efficiency strategy, money for building efficiency in the owner-occupier sector, which of course is a big sector in the UK, and we do need that quite badly. We also need to be doing rather better on rollout of heat pumps in residential and commercial build. Again, heat pumps are the things that use that zero carbon energy from renewables. So, those are, so that's my big five. The reason I mention those is that they do not provide all the answers. And I emphasize, you know, there's plenty of other stuff that needs to go alongside it. We need action on waste, on HFCs and F gases. We'll need action on innovation. We need a more circular economy. And I've completely left out, because it's interesting but complicated, the whole land use stuff. But in terms of delivering our targets, if we don't get this five right, we're not going to do it. And so time, energy, money, both political and technical, needs to be spent on these. Otherwise, we're not going to get where we need to get to. And so I'll finish. I've just said all that. It's going to be very difficult to get there without those five. And just to say that, as someone enmeshed in the civil society movement to deliver on climate ambition, I think we will see a shift in emphasis away from government setting targets. The government's got plenty of targets now. We will see a shift to a focus on delivery. What are you doing? How far are you going? How fast are you going? Are you doing enough? Rather than saying you need to say how many heat pumps are going to be installed by 2025. So the focus will shift to delivery. It might be slow, but it will. And there will be inevitably a focus on fairness, both fairness internationally, which I mentioned earlier on, about developing nations suffering the impacts of climate change, but also fairness in terms of how these policies are delivered. Because fairness comes up whenever there's any check-in with the population at large. It comes through in climate assemblies, both the national one and the numerous local ones. If these policies are not seen to be implemented fairly and help given to those who can least afford it to make the transition, then they will run into trouble one way or another. So if the focus is on delivery, then fairness needs to be a central part of what is done. And that's it from me. Thank you very much. I will stop sharing.